we were talking about robots. We weren't talking about the Japanese. I think it is racist for you to immediately go there.
That's a good point. I mean, I was imagining giant Chinese fighting robots, because I was imagining Power Rangers.
Is it a cultural observation, or are you just racist?
Why can't it be both, I think? Why can't it be both? Good
Indeed.
Lord. Racism. Welcome to the Racism Podcast, where we are racist for 2 hours every day.
All right. Do you want me to just jump in?
Go! Success! I'm sorry.
There needs to be silence before I start. Okay. You can't say success. And
no, I'm sorry. I just made myself laugh because I'm an idiot. Please start.
Welcome once again to the Slowpokes Podcast. As always, I'm Slowpoke number 2, David Chalante.
And I'm Slowpoke number 1, John Nicolaitis.
And the Slowpokes Podcast is where we play not old, but not current games
that
our busy lives didn't allow us to play at the time.
So busy, jet setting, flying around the world.
Stocks.
You know, business, trading, the deals.
Yeah.
So many
all
deals.
All those high-flying deals I do at my contact center job.
And the place I work at that I can't discuss. Any hoodle poodle, what are we here to talk about today?
John's a secret agent. I'm not supposed to say that.
You just said it. Now we have to start again. Do you know how many takes we've done?
Or I'm going to have to get murdered, probably.
Well, but then we still won't be able to release this if you're murdered. Which is not the point. So here, today, we're here to talk about
Life is Strange.
Yes, which I needed you to say because my brain wanted to say Last of Us.
Yes, because the new trailer only just got released for that, like a few
days
ago.
Dated the podcast.
Okay, I know that we're supposed to be talking about Life is Strange, but I've said the word trailer, and now I have to just say as well, and we're not going to go into it because we both lose our shit, Death Stranding trailer came out a couple of days ago, and yeah, right?
Oh my god, what the fuck is that? I don't know what it is, but I'm excited and aroused.
Yeah, I mean, this whole podcast enterprise is designed to sort of slow down the whole hype train engine.
We've already
but then
it.
Hideo Kojima comes out with a new IP, and it's just like, well, for fuck's sake,
fine.
But in a way, that's the kind of thing worth getting excited about, right?
Yeah, you know, something you're not sure about that seems creative and interesting. Like this game.
Yes, Life is Strange, the one we're actually supposed to be talking about.
Yeah, okay.
So, as I was saying just before, the whole premise of the podcast is we play games that we didn't really have time to play at the time that they were released. We're looking to sort of revisit these things, half nostalgia, half, you know, retrospective. And this episode's a great example of that because, John, you have played Life is Strange in the past.
Yeah, oh, I mean,
We've both played it a while ago.
Yeah, I didn't play it when it originally came out, but I did play it when all of the episodes were released, because that is how I play all episodic games.
That's fair. Like, there's only a handful of games, episodic games I haven't done that with.
But I think the original Telltale Walking Dead was the only one where I played them,
as they were released.
And then I was like, I will never do this ever again in my entire life. Mm.
So, Life is Strange is a game, obviously, I've heard a lot about, but I literally only finished that 2 days ago. So this is a very new experience for me, and that's one of the cool little things I like about the podcast, is that sometimes we'll be playing games that neither of us have played, and we're both just kind of meandering around in this new age of wonder.
Oh my god, this
but
is
other
amazing.
Times you know, I'm coming to something that you're quite familiar with, and
or you're coming to something that I'm quite...
You just said the exact same thing.
I'm a podcast expert, okay? So I think that's clear.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to this because you've had a lot more time to think about this than I have.
And that's true, yeah. And right now, I'm sitting with almost nostalgia. Like, this is an experience that I had. And you're coming to it brand new. Like, you've just had it. It's raw.
Yeah.
So.
One of the things we like to talk about at the start of the episode is what expectations we go into these games with. Like, with the whole cultural conversation that's taking part around us that I couldn't be a part of because I hadn't played the game.
Yeah.
Right?
And in this instance, you have expectations, but I have memories because I played it so... It's not like ages ago. It was like last year I played this game.
But when you say last year, in December of this year...
Yeah, okay, that's a good point.
Yeah.
What is years even? What is time?
Like 12 months, especially for a game like this, I think would make a huge difference. My expectations going into it were coloured very, very deeply by the conversation going around it, and this is a game that generated a lot of conversation in a lot of forms by MRAs calling it Tumblr the game.
Oh, good lord, I saw none of that.
Yeah, well, lucky you.
Yeah.
And as much as I despise that, you know, sort of segment of Twitter and all of that...
And that whole movement in general.
It is still surprising how that informed the conversation that was happening with people that I quite like. So a lot of the stuff I heard about this was through the Jimquisition podcast. Laura Dale is a big fan of Life is Strange. And the way she talked about it painted a very, very different expectation of what I was actually met with. So I was going into this expecting it all to be about, like, that awkward teen experience where, like, you liked a girl, but it was hard to say to the girl that you liked them, and then you had to kiss them, but it was awkward because you really wanted to kiss the girl that was pretty and that you liked them, but it's hard because you're a teenager and it's so awkward. So that's the kind of thing I was expecting. Like, very, 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 not realistic, but very, very low scope kind of interactive drama.
Right.
I was expecting, obviously, the time travel mechanic to feature in it, but I was expecting that to be very much like...
ancillary.
Yeah, well, not ancillary, but just about navigating the awkwardness of high school and then maybe, you know, ending up in the relationship with the person, like that being the core of the game. I was also expecting it to be very, very drippingly and infuriatingly millennial. And I was expecting, I'm going to lay it right out there. Despite everything that people said about it and how cool I thought it was that they loved it, I didn't think I'd be the kind of person who would. I thought I would go into it, be very frustrated,
yep,
and be very resistant to the emotions it was trying to make me feel. And I'm very glad to say that those expectations were disgustingly inaccurate.
Yeah! I don't know what happened with me, because I've only got my memories, the dotting memories of an old man.
Yeah.
But I had nothing. I had nothing coming into this game, except for some people saying, oh, the first episode's a bit slow.
Yeah, see, I didn't even have that.
Yeah, but it's interesting how, you know, your whole expectations into this game is coloured by all of this social kind of commentary.
Yeah. And I think that's something, obviously, we need to talk about we might be talking about again in future episodes, because a conversation can exist around these things that long before we actually come into them.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas you were a little bit freer of that, I was inundated with it. I couldn't avoid it.
Yeah, the way I kind of, navigate the gaming waters is actually very removed from most culture itself. I don't do communities. I form communities myself. So, really, I spend a lot more time listening to games critics and game reviewers and that kind of opinion. And so, sometimes, if they're not interested in things, they just won't talk about it. So, if they think something's bad, they'll go, didn't really like it, and they'll move on.
Yeah, but like I said, the vast majority of my understanding of what this game was came from things like podcasts and the like. It's just, I think it's just a timing issue where, because we listen to a lot of the same podcasts, where you're listening to something and you have the experience, you can probably understand more accurately what the person's talking about, where I have to fabricate that all from the get-go.
No, that's very true.
And so a lot of it is going to be, like I said, just my own, I say prejudices, like the prejudices that have been inflicted into my brain by, resistance to games like this, and the knowledge, because I hate MRAs, I hate, you know,
I think it's safe to say that this is an anti-men's right activist movie.
Yeah, we're not big into white supremacy.
Yeah, no offense.
Yeah, but anyway, we should probably actually get into the game itself.
Yeah.
So, just as a brief primer to the listeners, this is a very story-heavy game, and I am a huge proponent of playing games like this without ruining the story for yourself.
Yeah.
We're going to make our best attempt to keep at least part of this podcast spoiler-free, but it's impossible to talk about this game without spoilers.
It'd be like talking about any story game, where it's like, well, what was good? It's
at
like,
some
the story.
Point,
yeah, it's like, what else do you...
Yeah, exactly. So at some point, we are going to just drop the hammer.
Pull the trigger.
Yeah, we're going to pull the trigger on that. We'll warn you at that point, but as I said, this is not supposed to be a completely spoiler-free podcast, and so there might be points where we slip up. Just be aware, you've been warned. Let's talk about Life is Strange.
Yes.
So I think the first thing that we can talk about spoiler-free is basically the whole, atmosphere of that. Oh, so I was talking about that whole teen expectation, right?
Yeah.
Why don't we talk about that?
So when we talk about the atmosphere of Life is Strange, I think a lot of it is it's like pseudo high school experience, kind of a college kind of thing.
Yeah, it's very romanticized.
Yeah, I don't know when it's actually placed in terms of the schooling of the people.
Okay.
Because
I can answer that question.
Oh, well, good.
Yeah.
Because
the game is set in 2013, that all of the characters are in their final year of high school, but the school that they're at is a prestigious art school.
Right.
So it is high school level. They still learn maths and shit, but it's all about photography and visual art.
Yeah, because it felt like it was a very teenage thing, but then it was a bit weird. I was is this a college experience? I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
But I feel like it allowed it to kind of take a little bit from here and there, because it's very, very much that kind of high school drama kind of thing.
It's very focusing on that whole kind of high school drama aesthetic. But there are a lot of little things that do make that confusing. So, like, literally the first scene is a lecture about photography, and the stuff that they're getting taught is, like, tertiary-level stuff, which is very, very strange. I'm like, what era is this set in? And then it's weird because the game came out in 2015, but it's set in 2013.
Yeah.
But the basic feel of it, the basic atmosphere of it is it's palpable, right? It's... Again, like when I was coming into this for the first episode, I was very resistant to it because I couldn't stop thinking about that episode, that Strong Bad email about the difference between an indie film and an independent film. Have you seen that one?
No, I have not.
But it talks about how indie films try really hard to look less expensive and more young and like sort of slapdash than they actually are. So they've got like the hand-drawn titles and all of that kind of thing. And you go into this town and it's like the quintessential indie film, sleepy, dreary.
Hey, that's a great point.
American town.
It has all the tropes. There's a diner, right? Yeah. There's a pier and the beach.
And there's the jock with the Letterman jacket. All of that kind of stuff.
Everywhere.
And one of the things that I didn't realize going into this was that with a game like Until Dawn, which I haven't played, but when you go into a game like Until Dawn, you're expecting it to be really tropey. You're expecting it to be predictable in some ways and to just be like a very sort of paint-by-numbers experience.
And in fact, from what I've heard, Until Dawn plays into that. It's part of the
whole
experience.
And I think that when I was going into Life is Strange initially in episode one, I didn't realize that there was a similar kind of thing going on here with that. It was self-aware.
Yeah.
But the atmosphere is just fucking beautiful. Like, honestly, as resistant as I was to it, it won me over very quickly.
I think that's important because they do something very... I was very impressed by it, where they reuse the spaces quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And they do so in such a way that I noticed them doing it and was just impressed.
Yeah.
It was like every time I was like, oh, we're back here. Oh, but it's different. Oh, that's just... Oh, there's a part of me that was just like... I see why they put work into even like just the school rooms and just what they were doing
because
they were coming back and it had a plan.
Yeah.
And it's hard to see that in the first episode.
Exactly. That's something, again, like it takes a little bit of time to hone into the fact that a lot of the typicalness and a lot of the on-the-nosedness of the way the environments are designed and the fact that it's like this little fishing town, and so there's all like hills and forests on the side, and it's just that little bit rainy all the time. Mm-hmm. And so if you're not, like when I was going into it, I was just like, oh my God, this is so done. Like this has been done so many times. But if you don't, like it takes a while for you to actually click into the fact that the designers of the game are incredibly aware of that. And they're doing so very deliberately. And once I sort of let go of my resistance to it, that atmosphere overwhelmed me very quickly. And the school that you're in and the music that they play as you go from scene to scene, it's almost like being at like Hogwarts in a way. Quite so out there and so magical, but the fact that, you know, you're in this school that has dorms and so like you live on campus and all that kind of thing.
Which adds in a whole level of personality too. As like people have like, you know, one of the jokes that the game is like, you know, you navigate through personal spaces.
Yeah.
Not only is it a school, but it's a school where people live and they study and it's like a whole experience.
No, that's definitely true. Like that idea that every space is very, not emotionally grounded, you know what I'm trying to say? Like there is almost like a sensation behind every space that you're in. And they do like, you know, you have a lot of the environment because it's like I said, it's in a small fishing village. So you've got like the diner, like you were saying before, there's the junkyard where the punks hang out.
Yeah.
There's the railway tracks that they follow through the forest. And it's just really quite magical.
Yeah. And like, while some games, like they can take on like things and you have certain experiences with games and you're like, why is this room like this? Why are we here? And like Halo for me was a game where it was like, why are all these ruins structured this way? Like rooms. Like why are these rooms this shape? This makes no sense. But Life is Strange is a game that when you go through it, it feels real. It feels like people kind of live here.
Or definitely. Least, like without a doubt. Like it's very, very alive.
And while it may use a lot of tropes, because it does, it uses all of them, they still feel real and they still feel like they have character. Mm. So I think that's very important, especially when you cover yourself in the trappings of others.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the reference on the number plate to Twin Peaks.
So that's something else that I wasn't expecting, is that the influences of the game are very Not just are the influences of the game obvious, the designers make it obvious, and they make nods to the things that influence them. So you mentioned the Twin Peaks on Chloe's number plate.
Yeah.
There's references to Firefly. There's references to Twilight Zone and like 6 Feet Under and a Primer and like a bunch of stuff that I wasn't expecting in there.
And I don't think they handle it always the best. Mm. Sometimes they kind of wave a banner and they go, "Woo, this thing." And you're like, yeah, okay, you went to Wikipedia. Like, okay, right, fine.
Well, that's one of the things that I thought was actually kind of frustrating about the game is in the initial parts of it, is like, you know, you're in the photography school and they're talking about, you know, chiaroscuro and all this kind of stuff in a high school setting. And I'm like, okay, I get it, game designer, you studied film. But like, as the game goes on, you see very much that it is an indulgent experience and you start to appreciate the indulgence of it. Something else I think is incredibly interesting about Life is Strange is it's so specifically set in the era that it's set in, right? And it reminds me of something like The Breakfast Club, which I don't think they outright reference in the game to my knowledge, but you can't play a game or watch a movie about teenagers in a specific time without thinking of something like The Breakfast Club.
I've never seen The Breakfast Club, but I still think about The Breakfast Club when things like this come up and certain situations arise.
Yeah, I think what's really super interesting about it is this idea that it's so specifically... it is a romantic painting, but it is so specifically a painting of being a teenager in this time. Like, yeah. It's very deliberately not a timeless game. I think that's very admirable. Yeah, like that whole atmosphere and that whole teen feeling is
everywhere.
Just, yeah, it's very present and it's very not overwhelming, but like it really does create this real deep sense of immersion, and you're very much drawn in by that.
Well, yeah, that's true, and I think it's very important to realize that. Personally, I found this game incredibly immersive. Mm. I'm a sucker for like these teenage, especially female, these women going through experiences. I just like some part of me that just wants to get into that. And this game, it can welcome you in, and you can really start to just feel for the characters. I feel like they give all characters, and especially once you get past the first episode, even characters who you dismissed, they empathize wonderfully.
Yeah, and so this is something else that, about my expectations of that whole awkward teen being awkward, awkward teen, awkward, awkward. The character you play is called Max, right? And she's like a fucking boss. Like, that's one of the weird things that I was not expecting at all. Like, when you have conversations with these other characters, you know, especially big characters like Chloe, but the ones that stood out for me were like Alyssa and Kate.
Yeah.
She's just so emotionally accessible. Like, she talks to people and she's like, I noticed that you looked down. Is there anything I can do to help? And it's just, it transcends so heavily that idea of like I'm an awkward teen and I don't know what to say.
That is such a great point, because I never realized until this moment, because a lot of people actually, from my memory, talk about Max as being kind of a downer and being like a really kind of whiny, like from what I've experienced. Obviously, I haven't heard very much, but...
No, what I mean is, like, I completely disagree with that.
Oh, no. Yeah. And what I would say is, like, you're right. She is very empathetic. She is communicative with others. She asks... Now that I think about it, now I think back on it, I realize she always asks people very pointed, deep, personal questions.
At the beginning, I was a little bit concerned because they were, like, trying to create this sense of depth. You know, like, oh, they're into art and photography and they're a little bit hipstery and Chloe's kind of a punk. And I was looking at these as allusions to depth without actually conveying depth. But when I think about a character with conversational choices, like, say, Commander Shepard from Mass Effect, it's all very much like, I'm strong. I'm going to tell you what to do. I'm going to solve these problems because I'm a hero. But you never see Shepard, like, cry or feel empathy or whatever. Like, you can make Shepard get angry at something that they feel injustice at, but when you have Max, she just has this incredible, I say strength of character, but there is a greater depth to her personality and the personality behind her performance, which I think is so much bigger than what I was expecting.
And then that's a great point, and I think something that was underselled when people talk about the game, from my experience, and this never comes up, is just the way that she's like that, and the way that all characters in the game are done like that as well.
Yeah.
From the bad guys to the good guys to the ancillary characters, there is a lot of while there is some stereotyping and some kind of like, oh, the Asian character is a nerd.
Yeah.
The Indian character studies really hard.
Yeah. And the first character you meet who's a stoner is black.
Yeah. It's like, whoa. They are actual. They feel like actual people. Like,
I agree to some extent and I disagree to others. Max surprised me with her depth. Chloe did to some extent, but a lot of the others I felt followed. Even the, you know, when you say like the bad guys who, you know, we might want to avoid some of this stuff.
Yeah, of course. That's why I didn't want to get.
There are some ways where they build empathy with particular characters that are done. They are played. It's not a unique, nuanced. It is somewhat nuanced, but it's not a brand new way of thinking about things. They do follow some broad plot points, and in that indulgent way I was talking about before.
And then for me, this game was very, very weird because the two main characters are named after very prominent people in my personal life.
Yeah, just so we're clear, they're named directly after them as well.
I was actually involved, like, to be clear, I was involved in development. This is a very personal project. Oh, I should let you know. I made this game. This is my game.
Oh, yeah. Good.
I want to take all responsibility right now. Ubisoft was not involved in any way.
You said Ubisoft, it's not Ubisoft.
No, Ubisoft produced
it. No. They didn't.
They didn't?
No, it was... we have to fact check now. Thanks, John. The game was produced by a studio called Don't Nod. It was published by Square Enix.
Okay, well, we're not actually fact checking because you'd already written that down.
I have to...
You have to show me
that. Yeah, I have to call you out.
That's fine. I'm an idiot.
My journalistic integrity, it quavers.
We need to have standards, especially in a game that I helped make. No, but... The characters are named after important people to me, and it was weird as hell to start a game and the main character is named after someone you spent a lot of time being in love with.
Yeah.
And then her best friend and, you know, depending on how you want to look at it, love interest, is also named after someone from your past who you loved very much. It kind of added a whole extra personal attachment to the two main characters, which I couldn't shake through the whole game, and just became almost a little like, it kind of pre-prepped me. It was like it was triggering emotional cues in myself when they were experiencing things. And there's a lot of things that happen in this game. And while I haven't been through, well, I haven't time traveled, just so you know, no one needs to abduct me. There's a lot of experiences I've had that are similar to points in the game. And when the characters have this attachment to me, it just made the whole experience so much more personal.
Yeah. And so I'm glad you brought that up because I was going to ask about it. John and I have been friends long enough that I have met at least, I've met both.
I'm pretty sure you met both.
Yeah, I've met at least one of them.
Yeah.
We've been friends long. So I was going to bring that up. Like, do you think that when we get to the big decisions that you make in the game, which we'll save till the end of the podcast, we will be bringing that up again, I think, because I think it's going to play a part.
That's fair. And we will talk about it then.
One of the other things that I think builds a lot of that sense of atmosphere is the soundtrack in this game. Now, neither of us are musical aficionados. So
My first soundtrack I ever bought my own money was the Spider-Man 1 soundtrack. So, like, that's... If we're going to talk about cool...
You almost said Spider-Macklemore, and now I want to see that.
That would be an interesting mix-up. But yeah, just to show how not cool I am with music, Linkin Park was first concert. Spider-Man 1 soundtrack.
Yeah, I have not been to a concert.
that's how cool we are.
Now, the soundtrack in this game is very interesting because they use, obviously, just a general, like, sort of written for the game, like, backing scores that's very, again, I was resistant to it at the beginning because it's all, like, acoustic guitar and sort of whimsical indie hipster kind of stuff. But again, once you let go of your own frustrations with that, it just straight into an immersive state. The license, they use a lot of licensed music in this game as well, which I think is important for that whole sense of this is the moment in which this game exists.
The game talks about what's cool and what teenagers find cool and what they love and all this stuff. And if they didn't have licensed music, it would just kind of, the world would feel a bit absent.
Yeah, exactly. And there's some stuff they use very, 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 very well. Like there's a couple of, we were talking before the podcast about the games that use licensed music well, and you can count them on one hand, right? The only two that jump to my mind is Tales from the Borderlands, which you haven't played, and Bioshock Infinite. And in both cases, the use of licensed music is incredibly... In Bioshock Infinite, it's central to the plot. Like, it's non-diegetic. You know what? It is diegetic.
It's very intentional.
It's in the universe. I'll pretend that I knew what that word meant before I said it.
Let's all pretend that we know what words are. No, the usage is very... It's not just set dressing. It is part of the story. It's
Are you
part
talking
of the
about
narrative.
Bioshock Infinite?
Yes.
No. Yeah.
I am talking about Bioshock.
Yeah, it exists in that universe, and it's part of the core plot. In Tales from the Borderlands, it's used as part of these big set pieces. So it's not in-universe, but it's still very, very deliberate, and you're supposed to look at that and consciously notice it.
Yeah.
Whereas in Life is Strange, I feel like it's done more subtly, but as a way to really bring out that, like I said, that moment in time. And, you know, moment in time is what the fucking game's all about, right?
Yes.
The game has time travel.
Time travel! Time travel! There's parts with, like, butterflies, and you're like, butterflies, time travel? Oh my god! So clever!
So
there is a lot of moments where the game is kind of like, oh, I'm so smart! And you're like...
back on the atmosphere thing as well, there's a lot of nature stuff. You see a lot of squirrels and birds and like Native American totems and a lot of time spent in the woods with rain and all of that kind of stuff. It's just, animals are used very, very heavily to help that. But like, again, the music I think is what really brings you into it. And there's a couple of very clever little parts. Like there's one point where just as a bit of like a distraction, you can get Max to pick up a guitar and strum something out. If you go over and turn on her radio, that's the CD that she's got in. So she's clearly trying to learn how to play the song that she's listening to. Just little, like, there's a lot of little...
And like we said about the world being lived in, like, there's lots of that. Like, that's this, all of this thing throughout the whole game. It's peppered with things like that.
Yeah.
The choices and actions that people would do. And it's like, why are there explosive barrels in the middle of this room? Like, it doesn't make any sense. It's none of that. It's like, the things are placed. And I think it's very beautiful. I mean, but... On the note of, like, sitting down to play the guitar, the way you navigate through this game is very much kind of like that Telltale kind of moving character around, and that kind of stuff.
This is a weird thing as well, because I was expecting it to be more like the more recent Telltales, where it's basically dialogue to dialogue to dialogue to dialogue to dialogue, and then you might get a little bit of a chance to walk around and work with the environment, but then dialogue. In this game, you spend more time, a lot more time, like, actually... controlling Max, where she goes, what she looks at, whether she sits down, whether she plays a guitar, through, I'm trying to figure out the best way to explain this, but like actually directing her movements like you would in a quote normal game, you know?
This isn't a visual, it's like, it's not a visual
novel. Yeah, it's not a visual novel. Like you actually control Max and walk and look around and spend as much time exploring the world as you want to spend exploring it. But sorry, I cut you off there.
No, that's true. It was when you talk about the guitar, I mean, so the game gives you a lot of control over Max and it gives you this world that's very real, and then it just gives you moments to just stop.
Mm.
And again, it's a game about time. It's very important. Like, the game understands all about time. It's not just using time as in the narrative, but it's also understanding that, like, okay, well, we'll give you moments to explore and we'll give you moments to relate and then we'll just give you moments to reflect. And I think there's moments where you can just sit down and Max will just think out loud in her head.
Yeah, she has a bit of a monologue. And
which is great, because sometimes, I don't know about you, but sometimes I just think through my problems. And it's nice to hear the character just kind of go, man, this is this and this is that and what's going on.
And I was really, like... Initially, I was quite resistant to that whole, oh, she's so soulful and deep. But she, like I said, the character actually is very layered, and she is a deeply contemplative person. And I respect her intellect, and I respect, like, how she processes her emotions and all of this kind of stuff.
She does process her emotions, which is...
Yeah, exactly. It's just a really, like, almost a cathartic experience. Listen to her... sit down and think about what's going on.
The game is full of, like, moments where you just get to experience someone.
Yeah.
I think a lot of games, like, that take place around this kind of time, or movies or whatever, when they take place around people's teenage years and growing up, they don't ever really show people grappling.
Yeah.
They show, like, highlights or struggles, but they don't
just... And then,
just,
like, there's the point where, you know... George McFly punches Biff and he does it. He's not a nerd anymore.
Yeah, and he's grown as a person. Yeah. But there's never, like, the week before where he's just sitting there going, like, I need to do something. But what do I do? But do I do this?
Because when we think about it, just video games in general, like, I really like Max's kind of emotional processing, and that, like, they have a different definition of strength, which is beyond just not emotionally affected by this, you know? Oh, I'm stoic. I wasn't emotionally affected, but I remained fearless, you know? And all of the characters do react in that way. And, like, when you think about that kind of strength, like, that sense of grappling, and you compare it to something like Halo, where it's like, aliens, gotta shoot 'em.
Gonna punch the alien in the face.
I unleashed a race of zombie bugs that are going to destroy the universe. Oh, better shoot them.
Oh, David, spoilers, man. Spoilers for Halo. I'm sorry, everyone. Well, that's true. Also, but sort of going back to the, like, the gameplay, good Lord, I love how they use time travel in this game.
Yeah, it's so clever, right? Because
I'm so impressed. Like, your ability to... They use it in the narrative with having conversations. Mm. So in your dialogue options, the game is like, yeah, you can talk to someone, you can fuck it up, and then you can just reverse that.
Yeah, and obviously, like, the narrative illusion that makes with, you know, the alleviation of teen awkwardness and stuff is, you know, very, very present. All of the characters at some point in the game, either implicitly or explicitly... express regrets and kind of like that whole, man, I wish I could go back and change X. And it's like the fact that you have that ability and it's used in not necessarily petty ways, but personal ways, is very interesting for the narrative, but also just how it functions as part of the environments and like how they actually got that mechanic to work. It's very impressive.
I don't know, I'm just sitting around here going, it's so impressive. It's just so, it's amazing. Like, whether it's interacting with people or seeing things you're not supposed
like
to.
Or puzzle solving.
Making decisions. Oh, yes. See, now this is my problem. Because it's been so long since I've played the game, I've forgotten a lot of the gameplay aspects in terms of the puzzle solving. But, like, from memory, I'm remembering certain actions and things you can
there
do.
There are could points, you- like, it's not Braid. Right? It's not Ocarina of Time level of, like, it, you know, Braid is insane in, like, what it does with time travel. The Witness is insane in what it does with, you know, puzzle solving and all that kind of stuff. There are relatively simple puzzles, because that's not the core focus of the game, but yeah. When you solve them using your time travel powers, you're like, oh, that was clever. Oh. It's very novel little puzzles where, like, you know, you need to get a particular item, but you need to do X, Y, and Z first. But if you do X, Y, and Z, that'll do, you know, that'll cause some consequences. So you can do these things in a non-linear order that allow you to get to these results in a way that doesn't fuck everything up. It's just, there's a lot of little clever moments like that.
It's a game that sets up its kind of time travel mechanics, and then it kind of really explores them a little bit more than, you know, some other stories do. It really gets in there and it kind of really delves into it. I have a series of very famous, that is a lie. It's not very famous. It's very terrible pulp time travel. But it explores the ramifications of time travel in detail. And I think this game does as well in just in terms of how Max uses her power.
Yeah.
Chooses not to.
We were talking about the references as well. They have a bunch of references to, this kind of ties back to one or two points you were talking about that, Max, you see Max grapple with things. And when she starts to learn she has these time travel powers, one of the first things she does is a whole bunch of research. Like, it's not hardcore science and stuff, but she spends a lot of time on the internet. She talks to friends about things like chaos theory and different theories of time travel and relativity and all that kind of stuff. And one of the things that you see when she's looking through that is a list of movies that her nerd friends have told her that she should watch that kind of help her explore that.
Yeah.
And so that kind of harks back to two things we were saying. One, it shows her kind of grappling with this stuff in a way that isn't dry, but it also... nods to the illusions of the other things. And so you've got references to things like Primer and H.G. Wells' The Time Machine. And at one point, they talk about the Sound of Thunder, which, I mean, that's one of those things where if you've heard of it, it doesn't seem like a really out there reference, but there are a whole bunch of people who've never heard of The Sound of Thunder, which is like an incredibly, I don't know, turning point. It's a significant... time travel short story.
You can't see because I'm just shaking my head because I have no idea what he's talking about. I've never heard of Sound of Thunder.
Okay, so we all know what the butterfly effect is, yeah. Right? To my knowledge, I'm not an expert. To my knowledge, The Sound of Thunder was the first short story that used the butterfly as a symbol for the consequences in time travel.
Something that's done
they
in this game.
They spoof it in an episode of The Simpsons.
Okay.
So one where Homer goes back in time with the toaster. They're referencing The Sound of Thunder.
Oh, now I know what you're talking about. A Simpsons reference draws me back in with my knowledge. Another thing they do with the time travel is it happens at the beginning of the game.
Yes! Oh my fucking God!
It's not like they don't tease you throughout episode one.
Yeah,
it is
like,
oh, right
the
there.
The number of fucking games. Shadow of Mordor did it. Hydrophobia did it. Where they're all like, this is the big mechanic on the back of the box. I don't give it to you until like 60 to 70% of the way through the fucking game. Like, just give me the power. Dude, they give it to you right off the bat.
It's on the box.
Yeah.
It's in the trailers.
They don't waste... I was talking about how Max, like, does the research and stuff. She does that sort of quote, between scenes. Like, you see that she's had emails back and forth with people. And so, when you're looking at the research she did last night, she has a little bit of monologue. You can see that it was done, but they don't waste time with it. They give you the power, you learn how it works really quickly, and, like, the first actions you take, within 5 to 10 minutes of starting the game, you've rewound time.
Oh, yeah, almost immediately.
And it was so satisfying to have that straight away, and also have to be so incredibly intuitive.
Yeah.
You know, because you... just very briefly, like, you go from area to area, and once you leave the area and go to a new one, you can only rewind back to the start of that area. So if you go from the school to, like, the front courtyard or the car park, you can rewind back to the start of the car park.
Yeah.
And there are some other things where it comes in later that sort of reset the time reset points as well, but you can go back through and you learn things from conversations. You can rewind time and use them in conversation. But it makes so much sense straight away.
Yeah.
And I was very impressed by that. Because when you have a game like Braid, they spend a lot of time and energy.
Sometimes almost the whole game.
Yeah, like teaching you how to use that mechanic, right? And they have to in a puzzle-focused game like Braid. But in this, it was just so quick and then you know how to use it. I really, really like that a lot.
And in a game with, like, lots of narrative, it's all about these narrative decisions and conversations you have with people and how people interact with you. It has that feel throughout it. It does that very game thing of when you make choices. There's a lot of moments in the game where you make those clear choices.
Yeah,
do you do this or do you do that?
Those Telltale style,
yeah,
as we now refer moral to choices, them. Binary choices.
And the game does that thing where it tells you what everyone's done.
Yeah, like at the end credits, it kind of shows a breakdown of, like, hey, you and 37% of people did X.
Which I love. Like, I love that. And I know it's kind of like, it's kind of like poppy. It's not really like... But I just always love looking at what people did and what decisions they made and did they do this?
And I only just... Because you brought that up sort of before we started recording, but this only just occurred to me now. It's especially resonant in a game like this, which is all about trying to fit in.
Yeah.
You know, like when you make these choices and then you look at the breakdown of it, it's just like, oh, am I weird? Am I odd?
And also in a game that lets you rewind... things,
yeah,
right? It's like, not only does it's telling you, like, talking about fitting in and making decisions, but it's like, what decision do you want to make?
Yeah, and that's something I really quite like, because one of the things that frustrates me about some games with choices like this, The Witcher comes to mind, is that you'll make a choice and you won't really understand the consequences of it or what that means. Sometimes you'll pick the dialogue option and what you say isn't what you thought you'd say when you read the option.
Punch the woman in the face.
Yeah, it's like, and what's the other one? L.A. Noire is really bad at that. So it's just like, do you doubt this person? And you scream down their throat. What's cool about this is you can see how the conversation plays out and then rewind it and make a different choice. And what you get at the end of the episode, because it's an episodic game, is the final decisions you made in all of this. And we're going to start moving into spoiler territory now, because I think that it's important when we start talking about choices like this.
So everybody, bear in mind,
spoiler warning, all, like, safety's off. Let's go ahead. There are points in the game where they take your powers away for really big decisions, right? And it's not just arbitrary. There are in-narrative explanations for it, because, like, Max's powers have a big toll on her. So if she uses them too much, she can't use them again, like, because she starts bleeding out of her fucking eyes and shit.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are some really big moments where you only get one shot. And in some games, like, say, The Witcher, if I fuck that up, I might be a save scummer and just go back to a previous save. But in a game like this, they're like, no, this one matters. This one, what you do here is consequential. And I'm just like, fuck yeah, I respect that.
You can change almost every decision, but not this one.
Yeah.
It's like, no, make a decision.
And it's really quite powerful. It's like that you know, that classic juxtaposition, right? Like, you can't have a game that appropriately conveys dread without having moments of joy to contrast it. And in this, you can't have, like, those moments of, like, powerlessness in those moments is made so much more real by the fact that you're basically a god every other time you say anything.
Because you'd have thousands of conversations with people and everything about them, but then in these moments, it's just like, no, one shot.
Yeah.
I just loved it. I loved every part about it. I have never been more happy with it.
I was expecting something much less robust.
So with these characters and all these decisions, I think it can be really... The most important thing to me when making decisions in a game is... if I care about anyone. Because if I'm playing a game, and if it's a game about making decisions, and you don't care about anyone, well, then it's just worthless. You're just wasting your time.
Exactly. Like, we've already talked about Max quite a bit, and how impressed I am, not just with her, like, depth of a character from a narrative writing perspective, but also just, like, if I met Max in real life, I would just be in love with her. She's just an amazing person.
Oh, boy.
But the other big character is, obviously, Chloe, who is Max's best friend from childhood. She comes back to this town, like, 5 or 6 years after leaving it, and different things have happened in the past.
It's kind of one of those things where it's like, oh, different lives, we were friends, but now we had different experiences, and so now we're different, but we're kind of friends still, and we come back together. And the game is, like, about their friendship kind of reforging, or not, depending on how you play, I guess.
In the same way that Batman is made by his villains, I feel like a game like this is made by not the sidekick, but you know what I mean? Like, the primary supporting character or whatever. I'm not using the right terms to describe this, but Chloe is the most important character in the game, is what I'm trying to say.
Yes. It helps draw a mirror into Max's actions. Chloe isn't just a character who will go along with Max. She has her own reasoning. She has her own agency. And that's made very clear in the actions that when you make actions and decisions, you just feel like you're interacting with people.
Mm. And that's played out very strongly, because we'll talk about some of that stuff later. But once again, I'd like to remind everybody, spoilers are off now. So Chloe is a very fascinating character to me, because she hits a lot of those tropes. She does the whole punk thing, and I'm just like, is punk a thing in 2013?
Punk is a thing, David.
Yeah.
I
thought about this later. It's like, okay, maybe punk isn't a thing, but hipster teenagers embracing punk definitely would be a thing, you know?
For sure, of course.
Like, so that's not, I think, out of touch for them to have Chloe be punk, but she's very, she has that whole thing. She has a bad relationship with her stepfather. She's, you know, the troubled child, quote unquote. But she's got a lot of energy. She's passionate.
Which is a great foil to Max.
Because Max is very... She's not cold, but she's much cooler headed. And I know that how it sounds to say, oh yeah, here's this rocker chick who's got passion. Like saying words like that, if somebody pitched this to me as like a short story, I'd be like, oh, fuck off. But like...
Wait, which book did you take that from?
Yeah. It's like, oh, cool. Are they going to fall in love because they like the same song? But Chloe is a very, very fascinating character. And I think that, more than the actual writing and the construction of the character as a whole, I think that a lot more of how much I like Chloe goes to the performance of the actor. Chloe's voiced by, Ashley Birch, who won a couple of awards for this, I think.
Was it the Golden Joystick?
Golden Joystick. That was the big one that I read about.
I don't do award shows.
Yeah,
but...
neither do I, but like... It's one of those things where you go, oh yeah, she won the thing for best performance. And you're just like, yeah. If you're going to have an award, it should go to the person who deserves it the most.
Not anyone wins awards.
She did an amazing job with this performance. And in the first episode, like you said, a lot of the actors were trying to find the characters. The writing was a little bit off.
Yeah, boy. Hella.
Yeah, oh my God. Like, there was Hella, there was, what was the first thing Victoria says? I wrote it down. It made me want to shoot myself. She shows Max up in class, and then she says something like, well, I guess you're stuck in the retro zone now. Sad face.
Oh, my God.
And it's like, what are you doing? Who wrote that line?
There's a part of me that finds that actually endearing, because I do talk like that a lot of the time.
Yeah, but mostly. You do it ironically.
Yes, that is true.
Yeah, so, like, Chloe is a very fascinating character. I mentioned Victoria offhand, because one of my big problems with the characters, especially as I met them in episode one before they had a bit more depth going on, is they're incredibly archetypal.
Yeah.
You've got Victoria, the stuck-up socialite who's just a mean girl to all the other girls. You've got Alyssa, who's, like, the slightly overweight, picked-on nerd. You've got you were talking about the Indian scholar, so there's like an Indian girl who spends all her time studying. You've got the Asian girl who's really into tech, computers, and robotics. It's like, there's a lot of archetypes in this. And I think that they, again, it's deliberate.
Looking at it as a whole, you can see why they did that in the first episode.
And once again, when you let go of those like, ugh, sensations of seeing that, it becomes a bit deeper. But
I don't like telling people to push through something that might make them like feel a bit kind of like, oh, what is this? But like, it's only the first episode where it feels really just not, you're just not impressed.
Yeah.
And every episode after that, it's like, they work twice as hard to make up for it.
I think that, like, it's, but sometimes they don't, right? So you've got Warren, who's like Max's best friend at school, and he's like he's a nerdy nerd because they're all nerds, and somehow Max is still the picked on nerd who's into art at this school full of artists. But whatever,
it's like the nerd school of nerds.
Yeah, like at this art school of nerds, she's the nerdy artist. But
she does take all her photos with a Polaroid camera.
Yeah,
though,
yeah,
so
exactly.
In 2012,
because she's an analog girl. And like I said, once you get past that, but. We have Warren, right, and he's more the sort of the sci-fi kind of nerd. He's really into schlocky movies, he's good at science, and he's obviously in love with Max, right?
Oh my god, it is like a baseball bat through a window.
Yeah, and this is the thing, I'm going to talk a little bit about how obvious it is, but what you're talking about how, you know, near the start, they're very archetypal, but then they work later on to kind of give characters a bit more depth. I don't feel like Warren ever really gets that.
That's true, actually, now
I
that you mention it.
Like, the whole time, he's like this, he's the quote, nice guy. And from minute one, I'm like, look, he probably is a nice guy, but I'm getting a lot of red flags from this dude. I'm getting a lot of red flags. Like, he's not taking the subtle hints, right?
Yeah.
And then later on, I think in like episode four, now they do actually have him wake up a bit about that, and he ends up asking someone else to a movie or whatever. But there are points where, like, he asks you to a movie and you're like, oh, no, thanks, I can't go. And he sends you a text to tell you that he bought you a ticket anyway, just in case you change your mind. And
yeah,
I'm just
that
like,
was really not
oh,
cool.
Dude, like,
that's not cool, Warren.
That's, yeah, that's really...
I basically spent the whole game telling Warren to go away. I was just like, ha ha, Warren, please leave.
Yeah.
Ha ha, Warren, take someone else to the movies.
Yeah, I'm going to hang out with Chloe now, my female lady friend, who's a girl that is a lady that I'm hanging out with and spending a lot of time with, whose bed I woke up in this morning. Gonna go spend some time with my lady friend, Chloe girl.
Warren. Wink.
And he's like, oh, I'll get you a ticket anyway. Fuck off, Warren.
Warren, go away. I was, the whole game, I was just like, Warren, you're just not, you're a great guy, right? But yeah. Like, I don't have
and
the...
And when you say they do kind of backtrack on a couple of things, one of the things he does backtrack on is that he does at one point send you a text saying, oh, hey, I just, the whole Chloe thing just clicked. I'm going to back off. And like that, again, forms some part of Chloe's character because she's the one who tells him to back off. Right? Yeah, it is interesting. But, like, at the end of the game, you actually can, like, the last time you see him as part of gameplay, you can choose to kiss him. And that makes me wonder, like, I don't know how scripted the romance with Chloe is. You know, is that based on the choices that I've made, or is it clear that there's something emotional and romantic going on there?
I mean, there's always something interesting to say, because I was so immersed in the game that I kind of I really forgot like that it was like there are decisions that you can make, and yeah. What was the game showing me? To me, the game is a love story with Max and Chloe.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. But
and that's it. Like it's a love story between them, and it's I feel that because the game doesn't really directly address it, adds to like the subtext and almost makes it more real to me.
In a way, I because that's what I thought they were doing most of the time.
I don't know if they were actually doing that.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. That's what I felt. That's how I experienced the game. But I don't know if that's what they were doing.
So I'm very confused by it, because there is one moment where you can choose to kiss Chloe, but it's after she dares you to as a joke. And so you can give her a peck, and then that's the only physical intimacy they ever express for one another.
But it is telling where when you do, her reaction is...
She kind of brushes it off.
I read it completely differently. I read her as being, like, surprised that Max did it at all.
Yeah, and that she is like, whoa, look at you, taking charge or whatever.
But I felt like that was false bravado.
Yeah.
Of someone who got something they might have wanted but didn't expect.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I thought that was a very well-written scene.
Yeah.
And she jokes she'll text Warren to tell him he's, you know, barking up the wrong tree. And then she does that, which says a lot about Chloe. But other than that, there's not, like, again, this comes back to my expectations. I thought this was going to be a very explicit lesbian romance, right? But it's very, very subtle. It's nowhere, and like I said, the last time you see Warren, you can just choose to kiss him in a romantic moment of passion before you have to leave and save the day or whatever.
Yeah.
But you never get a moment like that with Chloe. You know, like,
no,
there's
true.
Big moments. We're going to move into plot decisions now, I think, because there are two big decisions in the game, both of which regard Chloe.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
And the biggest one, the one that struck me the most, the one that made me put down the controller because I was so cursed with indecision.
This is interesting because those two decisions are big and I don't know which one you're talking about right now.
There's a point in the game where you go back in time and you can change time to stop Chloe's father from dying.
You can't see my face, but like, I love this moment where it takes, I think the game takes a whole episode and it just, you're in an alternate dimension kind of where...
Yeah, so in the main timeline, Chloe's father died. You go back in time and stop that happening because you can, you do this thing where you find out you can jump far distances in very specific circumstances.
Oh, it's...
But in so doing, a bunch of other events change, which winds up meaning that Chloe is paralyzed from the neck down. And she's happier in some ways because her father's alive, but sadder in others because obviously she's in a very, very, very dire medical situation. And one of the things that I really liked about that, honestly, was how deep they go into that.
Oh, boy. They lean right into it.
Yeah. Like, when I first saw that, because when you go back in time and save William, who's Chloe's dad, I'm just like, okay, yeah, but what's the unforeseen consequence that's going to make us want to undo this? And then Chloe comes out and she's quadriplegic. And I'm like, oh, okay. I'm glad you could leverage disability porn. But they actually go into the realities of the condition and why it's difficult and, you know, that a lot of Chloe's relationships broke down because she didn't have the ability to see people and that there are medical... It's not clean. It's not just, oh, yeah, I can't walk. There's a lot of other, like, deep complications financially and just with Chloe's health more generally and mental health more generally. And they go into all of that. And it's so evocative and so, like, enrapturing and just... It just harrows you to your core. It's just...
That being said, we are two able-bodied people, mostly able-bodied, apart from some vision impairment. So we can't really talk from a place of having like a proper thing like that.
Yes, that's fair. Thank you for pulling me off
and,
that.
And while we can go, oh, they do this really well, we can't actually know, right? And
apparently, it goes back to that thing of like, they do it much better than most people would, but we can't say whether or not that's good enough.
Nor, I think, is it our place to say.
Yeah, no, you're completely right. The thing with this episode, though, is that it's, like I said, it's just absolutely, absolutely harrowing. It just, it rocks you to your core. Like, there are, you know, people cry during movies, people cry during video games. I'm not generally one of them. I can count the number of times I've cried during a video game on one hand. Yeah, this was one of those moments.
I was playing this game with my friend, Ollie, and I remember both of us just being like, we were just sitting there and we just talked about it. Like,
but we haven't actually said what the decision is yet, right?
No.
So, basically what happens is, you know, in this alternate reality, you and Chloe haven't started hanging out again. But you go and you visit Chloe, and she's very, very, like, happy to see you because she's, you know, lonely. A lot of her relationships have broken down. And Max is obviously feeling very guilty about this, and she's tearing herself up. It's like, you know, is what happened to Chloe... Like, but she still gets to see her father, and it's like all that kind of like the big question stuff.
What's more important?
Yeah. At the end of this whole segment, you know, you spend the day with Chloe, you take her to the beach. She's got a motorized wheelchair. You go back home. You watch Blade Runner together. You wake up together, and she's basically saying to you that she's had one of the most emotionally connected and you know, joyous days that she's had in a really long time. And she knows that her condition is worsening. She only has maybe a couple of weeks, a couple of months left to live. And she asks Max to assist her in dying.
Yeah.
And again, like, we can't ever know what the reality of a situation like that is like, but it is one of those decisions where, you know, this is why Ashley Birch won best performance for all of these kinds of moments. Yeah. You feel it. And you don't know what to do. It's really, really hard.
And to me, the really interesting thing about this decision is, regardless of what you make, you're just going to change time. Mm. But the game still makes you make the decision first.
Yeah.
It doesn't say, oh, no, go back and change time. It says, make this choice. This happens.
Yeah.
Then you go back.
And that kind of feeds into some of the time travel stuff in it, though, as well, because they talk about alternate realities in a couple of different ways, but one of the big ones they sort of focus on the most is that every time Max reverses time, she creates a new alternate reality, but there's a finite number of them. So it's not the infinite universes kind of theory. It's this idea that, like, okay, there are alternate timelines, and even though I'm in this one, that other one still exists. And so even though I made those decisions in that alternate timeline, and then I rewound time or changed something to go back to my correct timeline, that alternate one still exists, and what I did, what decision I made in response to Chloe's request still happened.
Yep.
Can I ask you what you chose?
I chose to assist Chloe.
Yeah. Me
too. Yeah, I just felt like, I don't know, you know, in the moment, when I talked about it with Ollie. We talked it through and I can't remember if this decision was just lumped on one of us. If we just went, no, you have to make this decision. And one of us just went, no, you've got to make it.
Yeah.
And I just, in that moment, it just... You know, because the characters are so wonderfully empathized, I just felt like acquiescing to that request.
See, sometimes you get trapped by the binary nature of these choices. And it's like, I feel like I said no, rewound time, and then said yes. And I was kind of trapped because there was that huge moment of selfishness where, like, it's like I want you to stay for me, you know what I mean? Like, and I didn't know how to put that into words. It's like, I'm not trying to make Chloe feel guilty in that moment, but like, this is the first time I've seen you in years, and it was amazing and it was wonderful and it was beautiful, and I feel this deep connection with you. Can we not just do one more day? You know, and like, I know how selfish that is, but that was my thinking. Like, that's what I wanted. But I realized that, like, with that whole, I'm going to change the decision about saving William anyway, I was like, well, I may as well give her what she wants. You know, I feel like in a way, my ability to control time undermined that. But it was, it was just such a fucking powerful moment.
The episode, like, that start of the episode, that comes out of nowhere, and it's, like, teased all through the start, and then you experience it, and it's an experience, and it felt very well handled.
The other big choice also involves Chloe's longevity.
So the
very end of the game, like...
End game spoilers.
Yeah.
End of the game.
So, in, there's a lot of references to...
Sorry, just quickly, before we get onto that, because I know we will, but... there was that weird other dimension-y kind of stuff that happened in the game.
Yeah.
And I just want to flag that as interesting, but...
Maybe we'll talk about what the choice is, because all of that is designed to set up that choice.
Good point.
Yeah, so the choice... basically, different characters at different points come to the realization that because Max is changing time, she's affecting nature around the town, and there's this huge tornado that's going to wipe through the town and destroy everyone.
Which is alluded throughout the whole game.
Yeah. It's like you get foreshadowing of that 5 minutes into the first episode.
Yeah.
You and Chloe are in a position where you know that you're safe from the tornado. And right at the start of the game, the first time you realize you have time powers is to save Chloe's life. And you're both standing up safe from this tornado. And Chloe comes to a realization that you've sort of come to before, in that all of this is happening because you fucked with time, and you started fucking with time from... when you saved my life that first time. So you need to go back and not do it so that you can save the town. And you choose between going back in time and sacrificing Chloe to end all of the disastrous weather events, or saying fuck that and letting the town be destroyed, but leaving Chloe alive. Before all of that happens, you go through this weird sort of other dimension-y kind of stuff. I interpreted that as Max basically just hallucinating.
Mm-hmm.
But you go through all of these different environments where different characters are yelling at you, telling you they hate you. Chloe is included in that. They're telling you how you've fucked everything up, and it's your fault everyone's about to die, and whether or not, you know, why don't you care?
And the game plays around with a lot of the characters and a lot of the imagery.
All of these relationships that have been demonstrated to you and built up until this point. And after it goes through all of that stuff, and it shows a couple of moments of Chloe just, like, saying, oh, yeah, Max is nothing. I'm going to fuck this random dude. And all of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Then it goes back to a point where it replays all of the touching, deeply intimate moments you've shared with Chloe over the whole thing. Have this contrast of everything that you fucked up, the value of all of the people in the town, everything Chloe could do because she's not exactly the world's most altruistic person. And then all of these deeply touching moments that you shared with Chloe. And then you wake up and have to make this decision. Do you sacrifice this town full of people or do you sacrifice Chloe? And yeah, that's another one of these difficult decisions. Can I ask you what you did?
I went first last time, so you're going to have to go first this time.
I saved Chloe and sacrificed the town.
I saved Chloe and sacrificed the town too.
Yeah.
Now, I want to be clear. The reason why I did it were entirely selfish. I said, nope, I worked this hard. I love you. Like, which is how I felt through Chloe and myself. I just like, I can't do that. I just can't do it.
Yeah.
And I guess apparently to me, if you put the lives of a town against someone I care about like that, apparently the decision I make is, sorry, fuck you guys.
Yeah.
Why did you come to that decision?
Honestly, there were a lot of things that were going through my head at that moment. And they would talk a lot about things like chaos theory and the stuff like that. And without wanting to sound like a huge nerd, they don't really get all of it exactly right. So chaos theory, as an example, is a mathematical theorem designed to test the outcomes of deterministic systems with impossible numbers of variables. It doesn't result in magic. When you have things like the infinite universes theory or the alternate realities theory, it's like, my decision here is actually irrelevant. I'm not choosing what happens. I'm just choosing which reality I live in. Both things are going to happen. So all of that stuff is going on in the back of my head, but ultimately, though, which is justification, it's the exact same thing as I was being selfish.
Yeah,
I like Chloe more than I like anyone else.
Now, I want to introduce just the third thing that happened. Because as I said, I played through this game with Ollie,
my
best friend of mine, and I hate to randomly bring him up. I don't. I lie. I love talking about Ollie. I can talk about Ollie for hours.
Yeah.
Hey, Ollie.
Hi, Ollie.
Great dude. He said, I'm going to butcher it. I'm sorry, Ollie. Basically, what he said was, no, changing things with time is what got us in this mess in the first place. Why should the solution be to change time again?
Again, that was something else that I thought. And I tend to retreat into rationalization a lot when it comes to facing emotional decisions. It's something I've talked to a number of health professionals about. It is a problem. But that was another one that came through my mind, is that, like, why would I be gifted this power only for the universe to get angry at me for changing the one thing I was given it to do, which was protect Chloe?
But again, that could just be human nature. And just like, that's the thing you signal out. You might not have noticed the Russian spy with the secret missile plans that the universe was trying to point to the whole time. Who knows what the universe is trying to do? But
I feel like, you know, I was given this power. And like, you start having flashbacks. You start having visions of the tornado before you get the time powers or before you save Chloe.
Yeah.
You were still having visions of that tornado. Mm-hmm. And so, again, that's just, I feel like that's a plot thing. But as I was sitting there and just making that decision, I'm like, ultimately, I don't think this is going to fix anything. You know, what if I go back in time, don't save Chloe, and then come back and the tornado's still fucking here?
There's no way you know that. And you know that the game doesn't let you change all your decisions.
Yeah.
It goes, no, some decisions count. Some decisions matter. Some things you can't change.
Yeah, and this, I knew this was going to be one of them. And when I chose to save Chloe, like, Max tears the photo in half because she uses photos to return to the moment where the photo was taken when she's traveling long distances in time. She tears the photo in half and I'm like, didn't have to do that. But the game needed the decision to be permanent. And I was sitting there thinking, it's like, I would have just put it in my pocket and then afterwards just seen, how many people did die? What number of strangers is worth Chloe's life? Oh, it was only six people? Fuck it.
Yeah.
It was 2,000 people?
Yeah, I don't know. Dave, you're not really a romantic, are you? Because, like, the whole point of it being permanent, it just adds to the whole, just the importance of the decision.
Like,
it's
said,
like, if Max was like, I won't do it now, but, you know, just in case.
Yeah.
That would completely change.
I'm the kind of person who believes in prenups, John, so I think
oh. Jeez, okay, is that where this is going?
No, look.
Anyway.
Ultimately, like I said, the reason I made the decision is because I cared about Chloe more than I cared about the town. That's it. Like, I can talk about all of the other rationale behind it, but they're feeble justifications that I was selfish.
And then coming back to the game itself, the game, the whole experience, gives you everything to make that choice actually matter. It's not just, like, who gets the biscuit, right?
Yeah.
It matters. It's a choice.
It affected me much more deeply than either of those decisions, the assisted dying for Chloe or the final game decision. That both of those affected me much more than the end game decision of Mass Effect or whatever.
Yeah.
There are a couple of decisions in Mass Effect that are mind-blowing, but nothing that kind of hit me as emotionally that deep. I think that... I didn't go back and choose the other decision. I haven't replayed the episode or looked that up online. I know, despite all my rationalizations, that the choice is only meaningful if it actually does result in saving the town. Like, it would be pretty fucking boss if you chose sacrifice Chloe and then came back into town and still got destroyed. I, in some ways, would want to give the designers a high five, but that is bad game design.
That would make everybody very mad. Angry, and it would go counter to what I feel is the way the game was going.
Because in that situation, there's a correct choice.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas in the real situation, in the situation that, as the game lays it out, there isn't...
Yeah.
There isn't a numerically superior choice. That's what I mean when I say correct, right? Like, if the difference was everyone in the town dies or everyone in the town and Chloe dies, the numerically better decision is to try and save Chloe.
Moving away from the ethics of deciding who should live and who should die, because this isn't a podcast about trolley problems. In terms of talking about the whole story itself, because I don't know that we really touched on that. We've touched on what obviously affected us personally.
Yeah.
But the whole narrative itself... I love that story.
Yeah, this is yet another thing I wasn't expecting. I didn't know that it was going to be a murder mystery.
It's awesome.
It's an awesome murder mystery.
Surprise!
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, anyway. Surprise!
Yeah, we've already said spoilers.
That's true. But
you don't actually find out the girl's dead until, like, episode 4, but we already said spoilers free.
Yeah, but it's just, like, powerful stuff.
And yeah, it's good.
I love how it came out of... Like, if you come into it cold, it comes out of nowhere... And it just... I feel like it's really well done. And I really loved it. I didn't see any of it coming in the way it came. And, like, I thought the twists were really well done. I'm a real sucker for, like, those horror movie tropes. And I can just... Or murder mystery or whatever.
Yeah.
So I'm always like, really? He's the bad guy? My God.
Yeah, it is predictable. Like, the first time I saw who the actual murderer was, I was like, that's going to be the murderer. But you get so drawn in by what the game does that I actually kind of forgot that I'd guessed that. And so when it came back to it, I was like, oh, I guess I was right. Maybe. Does it count if I forgot?
Yeah.
But yeah, it is interesting. One of the things I dislike about that, though, is that his whole character totally changes after you find out that he's doing that whole thing. And we already said no spoilers. If you're still listening at this point, you don't care. The murderer is... Jefferson, right?
Yeah.
So Mr. Jefferson, the photography teacher.
Mr. Jefferson, the teacher.
So it turns out that he's... Yes,
a murder dungeon.
Yeah, he's not trying to be a murderer, and he's not trying to be a rapist, but he's drugging women and photographing them.
Photographing
them. He's photographing them while they're sort of unconscious. Yeah. Against their will, because he feels like it's more honest. He wants to capture their innocence and all this kind of stuff.
It's a bit hammy.
Yeah, he talks a lot. He says the word innocent about 50 times when he's monologuing.
Which is 49 times too many.
And one of the things I disliked about that was that, like, once you're in the dungeon, his voice changes to the creepy voice. All of his discussions about, like, he loses all of the intellectualism and the study of, you know, photographic history. Like, I would have liked him to throw in something about culture changing or something that demonstrated that he was still that guy, you know, he was still the expert.
I think the problem is it's a B story.
Yeah.
Right? It's like...
By that point, it is.
By that point, it's the B story because the world's going to end. Like, that's a whole other thing that's kind of coming up. Like, the town's going to be destroyed and that's becoming your main focus.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it kind of becomes the B story. So, I think there's just like... Yeah, I think they were just like, how are we going to write this? Well, let's just write it like this. And then...
Yeah, it's hard to end shit.
Yeah.
It's very, very hard to end shit in a satisfying way, especially after, you know... whatever it was at that 12 hours of gameplay.
And, like, the game's not going to end either. There's, like, still stuff to go on.
Yeah. And so, like, I didn't like that so much. But the journey to getting to that point, where you're trying to find out what happened to Rachel and you need to get information from different people, is very, very engaging.
Anything that happens in a lot of those horror stories.
And this is very nitpicky
and
as
it's
well.
Also, like, it's kind of not the point.
Yeah,
like, the point
it's
is,
so not the point.
Right. And I feel that... If you're engaged in the story, like I 100% was, you just go with it. And it hands up, and you know what? Sometimes it's fun. And it's like, I think it needed that kind of manic upswing anyway, and they were just like, look, we need a kind of a high point here and things to get a bit crazy. We don't want him intellectualizing it and the player to come down at that moment. We want them to be high so that we can go through a swing.
And I do appreciate that. There are points where other games would trip and fall into over-explaining stuff that this game doesn't fall into. So I very much do like that. one of the things that I felt at the end of the game, because look, we've talked about this before on this podcast. We're going to pick games that we like most, like, or are excited players to play. Most of the time, we're going to love them. And overall, I'm shocked at how much I love this game and how deeply it affected me. But one of the things I do remember saying to myself when I was sitting through the credits is sort of sitting there wallowing in the emotion of it, listening to the soundtrack, just being very, very emotionally affected and going, I loved every second of this game, but I don't know if it was good. I had that same response after Interstellar, where, like, it's very emotionally affecting, it's very grand and epic, but you don't trust yourself to see its flaws because of how much you love it. And that was the exact same reaction I had to Life is Strange. Chris Straub says something about horror writing and jump scares. He says that, like, when there's a jump scare in a movie and you flinch, that doesn't mean that the movie is a good horror movie.
Yeah.
That's like tickling someone and claiming that you're a good comedian.
Yeah.
And I feel like games like, things like Interstellar and games like this, just because they know which buttons to press to get me to feel things doesn't necessarily mean that they're excellent. I won't know if this game is critically good or analytically good for another like 2 months when I'm a little bit more distant from the emotions of it. It's, if you ask me to euthanize someone I care about in a game, I'm gonna feel sad.
Yeah.
That's what's gonna happen.
I don't know about you, but that will elicit some of
an
my emotions.
An emotional response, yeah. Right? Thankfully, I'm not quite that sociopathic. So, it is an amazingly good game at, like, getting emotions out of me. But I don't know if that serves a greater purpose or if that's even a helpful thing.
Look, I don't think things need to change the world to make them good. I don't like to put things up against a scale of worth, right? So when we talk about something, it's like, I'm not saying, what is the worth of this? Is this valuable? Like, is this good? I don't know how much of that I care about.
Yeah.
Because to me, how did this make me feel when I was playing it, when I was consuming it? How did this make me feel afterwards?
Mm.
How has it affected me? Has it harmed me? Has it made me grow?
Yeah.
This game did not do no harm.
And that
question, being, this game did do no harm.
Yeah, this game did not do harm. But that's the important part that you said there, is like, did this game harm me or help me grow? Did this game harm our culture or help our culture grow?
Now, you're very close to this game because you just finished it.
Yeah.
Right? But from where I'm sitting, this game, it was a great experience. I feel like I explored a lot of myself in it.
Yeah.
I feel like I explored a lot of the characters, and I feel better for having played it.
Yeah.
I do not feel like my time was wasted.
Oh, God, no. No. And I'm not saying by any stretch of the imagination this game is bad. And even if it is bad, it's nowhere... Like, like you said, even if it is objectifying towards people with physical disabilities, or if, like, a lot of the archetypes, which I feel are, quite frankly, racist. There are racially motivated archetypes in this game, which is a type of racism.
And no matter how good it is, doesn't excuse
that. Yeah, it doesn't excuse that, exactly. So even in those places where it does fall down, I don't think it falls down anywhere near as badly as a lot of other games or movies that we might see. I think that it's a very thoughtful piece. I'm very interested to see how I feel about it in a year, especially since it exists so specifically in the time that it's set. But everything that you've said, I can't disagree with. I am deeply emotionally affected by it. I'm glad I played that game. I am rethinking my priorities in life for having done so. There have been decisions that I've made that have made people ask if I'm okay after playing it. And all of that is because of the power it has in affecting me. And I used to turn my nose up at that a lot, but as someone who experiences anhedonia as a symptom of my depression, it is very powerful to have games that do make you feel, and do so in a way that doesn't feel entirely exploitative.
And disrespectful.
I feel it's a healthy way, and we come right back down to Max and Max's emotional health and her ability to process the situation she's going through in a way that isn't two-dimensionally stoic, but also isn't feeble. You know, she is just a very, very, like I said, cathartic character. And I was about to say something kind of wanky there, but I feel privileged at having met her.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
You know what I mean?
I feel better for having met the experience of these two characters.
Yeah.
I mean, the characters, but like, characters
affect
us.
A lot of people are going to say that Chloe is a favorite character. For me, straight up, it's Max. Well, no doubt.
Yeah, it's fine. You can be wrong. So. And on that note, I really think that we've said pretty much everything I feel, and this is a good time to just go, Life is Strange, lovely experience, forever changed, great time.
And great game to play with someone who's not a gamer.
True. Definitely true.
So that was Life is Strange. Our next game is probably going to be Bloodborne.
Bloodborne. Bloodborne is a game I always wanted to play. I was very excited about it. I mean, it's the whole point of the show. It's like, oh, games we always want to play. So excited. I have grabbed my hands on a PS4 and a copy of Bloodborne. And I am eager to get to grips with it. And not only play the game, but I do want to get into a bit of the multiplayer experience and see if we can do some of that as well. So try and get as many of
the problem with Bloodborne is right now I do not have access to a PS4. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
But I am very keen to give that a go. I've never played a Souls game, but everybody I know who has is fucking in love with them.
And there's the other three Souls games, but I don't want to play all of them. I just want to play kind of one.
Yeah, I feel like... I was told I was wrong for thinking this, but I do feel like Bloodborne is going to be the most accessible, if from no other point than a narrative one, because it's a standalone sort of world.
Yeah.
And anyway, yeah, that's coming up probably next week.
Yep.
I'm looking forward to that because it's sort of, once again, we're going back to sort of a big scale game.
Yeah.
It's got a very, very difficult game to follow, I think. You know, like, coming after Life is Strange. Oh. We're setting a high bar for its expectations.
I mean, personally. But, I mean, it's a whole different style of game. I mean, while you can say that the game experience itself in Life is Strange is really great, Bloodborne is a combat action game.
Yeah, but, like, that's... I don't know if I'm going to feel like, after going through something so narratively powerful, going into something that's a bit more hack and slash, is going to be...
I have heard a lot of things about the crafting of the world...
But that, and that's the thing. I feel like there's a lot of narrative in there, but it's a very different kind, and I don't know how much I'm going to be affected by that. We'll see.
We'll see.
That's a whole point of the process.
Yeah. Like I said last time, or like I say every time, we played a game we didn't play.
Yeah.
We always wanted to. And that means we're better.
I've played a game called Life is Strange that has made me feel more alive.
Yeah.
This podcast is a success.
It's a success.
Yeah. If we never release it, it's a success.
It's still a success.
Speaking about that, though, if you would like to get in touch with us, you can do so in the comment section below whatever
we're hosting this.
Still not 100% sure how that's going to take form.
On our webpage, on the rock, on the hill.
Yep. We'll also have a email address, which the link will be in the description. And also, I'm going to insert that now.
That's slowpokespodcast@gmail.com. We're also at slowpokescast on Twitter.
Oh, what a great email.
I love how perfectly crafted it is. There's just so many layers that you can absorb there.
Magnificent.
Real easy to remember, also just very evocative. It's like, it's a micro poem is what it is.
Really? In that email.
For the digital age.
Which is the age we're in.
Well, anyway, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
See you around. Why did I have to see you around? I don't know.
I can cut that out.
Thanks for joining us for Life is Strange. You can see more stuff at our website at slowpokespodcast.com and follow our Patreon at patreon.com/slowpokespodcast.
The Slowpokes theme song is written by Travis Bonner. If you want to check out more of his stuff, go to jennybitesback.bandcamp.com. The Slowpokes logo was designed by Thomas Blackman Bishop. You can check him out at cardialnetwork.tumblr.com.
Join us next time for Bloodborne, and we'll see you later.